Okay, so we shall continue with the Majjhima Nikaya 26, the Noble Search, the Arya Parisana Sutta. And we have just seen how the Buddha-to-be, he reflects on the difference between the Noble Search and the Ignoble Search. And the Ignoble Search is when you search for those things that the problems that you have already have yourself, and you go searching for things that have similar problems in the world. And we have looked at the idea of birth or rebirth, and we're going to carry on with the other qualities here. So the Buddha goes on. He says, what should be described as liable to grow old? Partners and children, male and female bondservants, goats and sheep, chickens and pigs, elephants and cattle are liable to grow old. These attachments, upadis, are liable to grow old. Someone who is tired, infatuated, and attached to such things, themselves liable to grow old, seeks what is also liable to grow old. So it's kind of obvious. One of the things that kind of strikes you when you read this is that it's so obvious. We all know these things, and it's very easy to kind of read this and think, of course, I know this already. Don't really have to read it very carefully because, of course, we know what old age is all about, right? That's what we think, and it's very easy to read these things too superficially without really contemplating what is going on. So obviously, the reason why the Buddha says this, it must be important, right? It must really matter. Otherwise, it wouldn't kind of go on at such length with something that is so apparently obvious. And so it's really worthy of quite a bit of contemplation. And this is why it is there, why the Buddha states these things. Simple things. The Dhamma is often very simple. And sometimes I get challenged, I get told that I make the Dhamma too complicated. So I thought, now let's keep it simple and get back to the very basic things. And maybe there's some truth to that you know, sometimes you make things too complicated. Too much discussion of dependent origination, too much discussion of things that are really maybe not that significant. The simple things in the Dhamma are often the most important things. And the reason why they are important is that we can actually understand them, we can use them, we can apply them in our own lives. And that's why they are so important. So we can take it that right now, we're actually dealing with some very fundamental and important things in the Dhamma, because this is something everyone is capable of applying. So old age, the description of these things. Let's carry on. I'll get in, talk about this in more detail in a second. I just want to go through the initial stage first of all, and then we'll get into the details of this. And what should be described as liable to fall sick? Partners and children, male and female bondservants, goats and sheep, chickens and pigs, elephants and cattle are liable to fall sick. These attachments are liable to fall sick. Someone who is tired, infatuated, and attached to such things, themselves liable to fall sick, seeks what is also liable to fall sick. It's kind of obvious again. Of course, these things are liable to this. And the problem is, of course, that we forget this. And this is why the Buddha has to kind of make this point, again and again, with all of these obvious little details. In case you wonder what bondservant is, a bondservant is roughly the equivalent of a slave. Maybe not quite as, it's not as bad as a slave, but it's a similar kind of thing. You are bound to your master in a certain way, and you are a servant. That's essentially what that word means. It's kind of fun when you deal with this kind of translation. Sometimes we get into, arguments, but friendly discussions, I should say, with translators. I remember sending a message to the person who did this translation. You may be able to guess who it is. And I said, bondservants, no one has ever heard of bondservants. What kind of word is this? What dictionary did you find this word in? And I said, why not just use the word slave? Everyone knows what a slave is. And I got the stern telling off, no, bondservants is exactly the right word in this case. And so I said, okay, I kind of backed off a little bit after that. Okay, it's your translation, do as you see fit. And it's probably true, it probably is exactly the right word, but it's always a trade-off between using the right word and making the text comprehensible. And that kind of is kind of the issues in these things. It's kind of a difficult trade-off sometimes. So, anyway, what should be described as liable to die? Partners and children, male and female, slaves / bondservants, goats and sheep, chickens and pigs, elephants and cattle are liable to die. These attachments are liable to die. Someone who is tired, infatuated, and attached to such things, themselves liable to die. Six, what is also liable to die. And what should be described as liable to sorrow? Partners and children, male and female bondservants, goats and sheep, chickens and pigs, elephants and cattle are liable to sorrow. These attachments are liable to sorrow. Someone who is tired, infatuated, and attached to such things, themselves liable to sorrow, seeks what is also liable to sorrow. We see all the animals are also liable to sorrow. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Yeah. Often you will hear stories about animals who have emotions just like human beings. It's a very common thing, especially the higher animals like elephants and I guess all of these animals here. They are also liable to, because they also get attached. They also bond very often with other animals and they get liable to the same kind of things. And this was obvious to people 2,500 years ago. And it's kind of astonishing that in the large parts of the Western world, this was kind of forgotten about. Animals were often seen regarded as machines without any kind of feelings or emotions. It's kind of a crazy way of thinking about the animal realm. So here, this is kind of the right way of thinking about animals. They have emotions. They're very similar to us. The difference is actually quite small. And that's why it is possible to be reborn as an animal, because of those similarities. And what should be described as liable to corruption? Partners and children, male and female bondservants, goats and sheep, chickens and pigs, elephants and cattle, gold and money are liable to corruption. These attachments are liable to corruption. Someone who is tired, infatuated, and attached to such things, themselves liable to corruption, seeks what is also liable to corruption. This is the ignoble search. So here we have the idea of liable to corruption. It's not maybe not quite as obvious what this means. It's probably fairly obvious. You will notice here that you have added the idea of gold and money. And gold and money, when it gets corrupted, it loses its value. If gold gets corrupted, it gets contaminated by some other minerals or whatever, it loses its shine, it loses its value. It does not really consider gold anymore. When money is counterfeit, it loses its value, it's corrupted in a certain way. But what is interesting here is that all of these animals and people are also liable to corruption. The Pali word here is sankilesa, I believe. And sankilesa is similar to the idea of upakilesa, ukilesa. And of course, these are the corruptions of the mind. These are the kind of the ill will, the anger, the violence, the desires, the greed, all of these negative qualities that are so always there, lurking under the surface, waiting to come out. So people are liable to these things. And it's kind of interesting, because if people are liable to these things, it means that these things can re-arise in us. Maybe you think that you are quite fairly pure kind of person. I don't know if that's what you think about yourself. Yeah, I'm pure. I don't know if that's what people think about themselves. It's kind of a strange thing to think about yourself. But anyway, maybe you are quite pure, right? Just from an objective point of view, if I look at you, I will say that you're probably quite pure. Yeah, to me, you look like you're quite a pure person. But that is very unreliable. It's very uncertain. Getting the wrong influence in life, having the company with the wrong kind of people, and suddenly the defilement starts to creep back again. The mind is conditioned. The mind is not something that is solid, that can stand its ground against all the defilements and all the influences of the world. The mind is always changing. And when I look at my life as a monk, I've been a monk for quite a long time now. It's getting close to 30 years, actually, which is kind of a long time. Is it a long time? I don't know. Long is kind of a very relative word. And over that period of time, I can see that there has been a change, a dramatic change in outlook, in the way, in the kind of purity of the mind and all of these kind of things. But it's not reliable. It is not solid. And if you go take a wrong turn on this path, suddenly you find yourself being corrupted again. It is a bit like, you get married to someone, or you have a partner in life, or you have children or whatever, and you will see over time they change. And you get married to one person, and down the track the person is completely different. Why? Because they are subject to corruption. This kind of scary thing in life. And especially when we ourselves are subject to corruption, it is scary, because it means that we're not really in charge. We don't know where we're going to head. We don't know what's going to happen around the track. And of course, once you are subject to these defilements or corruptions of the mind, you start doing crazy things. You start following those corruptions. They are in charge. They lead you down the garden path. And suddenly you do all kind of crazy things. And it's amazing how difficult this is to see. And the reason why it is so hard to see is because of the sense of self. The sense of self tends to project our present state, our present mind state, into the future. We think that the way we are now is the way we're going to be in the future. Yeah, this is the idea of the sense of self. There's a feeling of continuity, but it's a false sense of continuity. And because of that, we are deluded into thinking that the person we are now is also the person we're going to be in the future. You're not going to be like that in the future. This is wrong. There was an interesting study, actually, I was reading about just recently. This comes to mind now. And there was a study of how people, when they look into the past, they can kind of see that they have developed. So you look back 10 years and they see, over the last 10 years I've changed like this because of circumstances or whatever. Now I'm this kind of person, as a result of, the influence of the world. So when they look into the past, they can see the change in character. But then they were asked to look into the future and predict who they would be in 10 years from now. And when they looked into the future, they always said, I'm going to be the same person in the future 10 years from now. Even though they knew they had changed in the past, looking into the future, they were going to be the same kind of person. So we are not able to see the changes in the future. We're not able to understand the influence, the conditioning from the outside that kind of molds you and changes you into a different kind of person. And this is kind of scary. Because it means that we're not really in charge. It means that it's very uncertain where we're going to be down the track. And for that reason, now is the opportunity to make a change. Now is the chance to actually ensure that that doesn't happen. How? By practicing this path. So we are liable to corruption. The people around us are liable to corruption. We don't know what's going to happen to the people around us. It is just so uncertain. And of course, it can be very difficult to deal with when people changes, when people change, and then you somehow have to kind of deal with a completely new situation that you never really anticipated before. So these are the various kinds of problems, right? And all of these things are problems in the world, and then. The Buddha goes on, having now described the ignoble search, the searching for these kind of things. And you will notice that the search here refers to the fact that you are tied, infatuated, and attached to such things. Because when you are tied and infatuated and attached to things that have these kind of qualities, it means that you have a vested interest in these things. A vested interest means that you desire them to be in a certain way. If you want the things that you own in life, you want them to be in a certain way. You don't want them to disappear. You don't want them to change. You want them to be reliable, when in fact they are utterly unreliable. This is the problem. So it's so simple, yet so profound at the same time. It's just kind of really interesting here. And then the Buddha goes on. And what is the noble search? is when someone who is themselves liable to be reborn understands the drawbacks in being liable to be reborn, seeks the unborn supreme sanctuary, extinguishment. So the idea here, and this is where we're talking about right view. This is why this is about right view. Because you're under someone, you are liable to be reborn. Yeah. First of all, this is kind of the first thing that you have to kind of accept. Yeah, you're liable to birth or rebirth. And then you understand the drawbacks in being liable to be reborn. So you have to see this reality, and then you have to reflect on that reality. What does it mean to be liable to be reborn? And of course, what it means, and this is where the whole idea of rebirth as right view is so important. And this is where the Buddha kind of gets it right, or the Buddha to be gets it right. It's this vision of the future, the kind of moving on in samsara, yeah, the kind of the continuation of this thing, again and again and again, going through the same kind of problems. And it is like when you see this, when you understand this, it's like a nightmare in a sense. It's this kind of the Groundhog Day scenario, doing the same things again and again and again, never really learning. You never learn because you forget in between lives what you learned in the past life. And so understanding, having this broad vision of reality, understanding what is going on is so important. The idea that rebirth doesn't make any difference for your spiritual practice, I think that is a complete misunderstanding of what this is all about. It makes a massive difference if you understand what is going on. It really makes you practice because you can see that there is a serious problem here. Well, one of the drawbacks of reading the suttas is that the way that rebirth is explained, the way you read about it, it is quite dry. Yeah, it is not really very, you don't really get a very good feeling for it. It's dry because it is kind of explained in a very sort of rational and very prose, kind of dry prose way, because these are suttas that have been kind of refined over a long period of time. They are very kind of uniform in style. They don't really bring out very much emotions, in my opinion, unless you think about it very carefully. But it's quite hard to think about it carefully. So sometimes I think it is good to read also some other material that kind of brings out the idea of rebirth and makes it much more emotionally tangible. You can actually feel what is going on. Remember what I was saying before, I think this is really important, is that the Dhamma should be something that you feel. When you feel it in your guts and you kind of feel, wow, this really matters. That is what drives the practice. The practice of Buddhism, the practice of anything in life or whatever, is never driven by rational thought. Rational thought may be a small part of it, but what drives you is inspiration. What drives you is concern for the problems in life, right? When you are inspired by something, that is when you are driven to do things. And inspiration, a large part of that is feeling. Yeah, something feels right. That's why you are inspired. So we are driven by feelings. We are driven by this sensation that there's something important to be done here, something that actually matters in life. So we need to bring out the feelings here as well. The feelings, what it means to be reborn. And one way of doing that is to read some of these stories that are available. I have sometimes read books about things like near-death experiences or, you know, this sort of thing. I read one book very recently that was really fascinating. And it was written by probably what is the world's number one authority on near-death experiences. And there were basically all these tales from ordinary people and telling about their stories, what happened to them. And that is very powerful when you hear ordinary people telling their stories about what happened. Yeah, they almost die. They get hit by something large, and they kind of, the body is completely out of it, and they kind of get released from the body. And that whole experience, when you read about it, is very powerful. And it kind of adds something to the suttas. It adds this realistic side to it. And you can actually get much more emotionally involved in what it means to have a near-death experience or a rebirth experience. Suddenly it starts to matter. Suddenly you feel what these people felt. And what is so fascinating when you read about these near-death experiences is that people who have them, they are changed. After the near-death experience, after your mind kind of comes back into your body again, you are a different kind of person afterwards. And one of the most important things that happened is that you become more spiritual. You're no longer so interested in the worldly things. You're no longer so interested in the material goods in the world or status or all of these kind of things. All of that is kind of become secondary. And instead, you become interested in just being kind, in living well, in treating people well. That is what matters to you. And it was interesting because when I was reading this book, the partners of these people who kind of had this experience, they become really upset. Yeah, before you used to work really hard, yeah, so that we could get all the kind of things that we need in the house. We could have a bigger house. Now you don't care about these things anymore. Now you just want to be kind. What's wrong with you? These kind of people don't get it, right? If people don't understand that actually the transformation here is a very positive one. Of course you have become more kind. Of course that is the outcome. But what a wonderful thing that is. You've given up some of the selfishness, given up some of the greed, some of the attachments to the stupid things in the world, because you have seen a larger picture. This is the point of this idea of rebirth. You see something more, and people get powerfully affected by it. And if you read those stories, you don't actually have to have a near-death experience yourself. If you have it, it's great. But often it is enough to read the story. And when you read the story, I guarantee you, you too will be affected a little bit of the same way as those people who had the experience. Why? Because they're ordinary people telling you the stories. You can't really dismiss those stories. It's impossible when people are just telling them. And then you get affected as a consequence. This is how to make it come alive a little bit more. Yes, reflect on it as it is in the suttas, reflect on the idea of rebirth, but it can be difficult to fully gain that emotional connection to what is going on. But when you read those stories, it is much more easy to get that emotional connection, and that is what is going to drive you on the path. So the idea of rebirth, right, it changes you. You look at the world in a different way. You start to understand what really matters. And part of the thing, part of what you understand, is that you understand that actually this little life we have now is only a small little thing. It's kind of insignificant. The world is so much larger. And if I'm going to live for anything, I have to live for this larger thing. I can't just live for this one life. It's kind of crazy to live for this one existence when the reality is so much larger. So you start to understand, well, if I'm going to live for this larger thing, then how I live is so important. Why? Because how I live, that is what is going to affect you in the long run. How you get reborn, where you get reborn, all of these kind of things. And this is the intuition that these people have when they have near-death experiences. It comes back to this beautiful simile that you find in the suttas, the simile of the borrowed goods. Yeah, the idea of the borrowed goods, that everything we have in this life, everything we have in terms of possessions, in terms of relationships, the people who are close to us, the status that we have in this life, all the things that belong to this world, they are so incredibly temporary. They last for a short while. They are like the borrowed goods. How much are you going to invest in borrowed goods? Are you going to invest in the bigger picture? Are you going to invest in those things that you actually own, that you actually can take with you? Or are you going to invest your time and your resources and your energy in borrowed goods? It's kind of obvious, right? Forget about those blooming borrowed goods. They are irrelevant. Yeah, you only have them for a short time. Yes, they are part of life. You can't really avoid it. But what really matters is the big picture. And investing in the big picture, the Buddha says there's only one thing that we own in this world. And we are the owners of our karma. That is what matters. And your karma, what is that? Well, that is how you live your life. Live your life well. That is what is meant by good karma. And then you're on the right track. Then you are taking the big picture into account. So you don't need to make any big changes in your life. You can live the way you do now. But it is how you live that life that changes. You live it with more care. You live it with more kindness, with more generosity, with more understanding, with more compassion. Then you're on the right track. This is the idea of the borrowed goods. And this is what comes out from a proper understanding of the idea of rebirth. So it's very rich, right? It's not just about saying, I believe in rebirth or anything like that. It's a rich insight into the nature of the world with massive consequences for how we actually live our lives and for how we look at life. This is the power of right view. This is the power of looking at the world in the right way. So you may wonder, well, so how do we actually, from a practical perspective, how do we actually get this right view? Well, I've been telling you now, how part of the way to do that is to maybe read a book about these things, to contemplate these things. But a very important part of this is this continuous contemplation of things. Yeah, it is when these things are continuously contemplated, that is when you are gradually reconditioning your mind. We come into this world and our minds are very heavily conditioned in a certain way by our past. And the only way we're going to be able to change the way we think about these things is to recondition our mind. It takes a long time. It's a difficult job because the power of the conditioning is so strong. And the only way we're going to be able to change is a gradual movement of the mind. And the more we contemplate this, the more the mind gradually changes in a different direction. And we take on board the idea of rebirth and all of these other things that are here. But it needs to be contemplated again and again and again, often continuously, often for long periods of time, because the conditioning is so strong. The only way to do it is then to keep on at it in this way. The habits from the past are so powerful. The momentum is so strong. And the only way you can kind of gradually go in a different direction is by slowly, slowly moving in a new way, thinking about the world in a new way. This is how you overcome this. So much of the Dhamma is actually contemplation, reflection, thinking about things in a new way. So you see the drawbacks in being liable to be reborn. And when you see the drawbacks, then you seek the unborn supreme sanctuary extinguishment. The unborn here is obviously, if the problem is being reborn, then it should be the freedom from rebirth. Yeah, this is what unborn means here. It means the freedom from rebirth. So you seek freedom from rebirth. This is what this means. And then you have the supreme sanctuary, the Anuttara Yoga Kema. And sanctuary, yoga, is the same words that we have today in yoga. You have kind of, you know, all these poses, you stand upside down, all the kind of poses that you do. That's kind of same word, yeah? Goes back 2,500 years. But in the suttas, it doesn't mean all these postures, yeah? It's not the kind of yoga kema, the freedom from postures. That's not what it means. What it means here, yoga here, means exertion. You exert yourself. Just like a yoga posture, they call it asana, I think. They are like a kind of exertion in the same way. Here it is an exertion. It's a general idea of exertion. So kema is like safety or freedom. So you have the safety from exertion, yeah, the sanctuary. You can rest, you can breathe, you can relax, because you're no longer bound by this terrible rebirth going round and round. So you are seeking the supreme sanctuary, extinguishment. Extinguishment here is nibbana, extinguishing rebirth, making an end of rebirth. Extinguishment just means something coming to an end, and that is what this is about. Nibbana. It's nice to translate nibbana because it means extinguishment. And if you don't translate it, then people are going to think nibbana means this, it means that. But actually, no, it means extinguishment. So it's nice to have it translated. So I agree with Bhante Sujato, who is the translator here, that that is the way to go. So there you are. I just gave away who the translator is, in case you're wondering. I'll show you some markers of Bhante Sujato later on, so how you can always know this is Bhante Sujato translation. So you have no doubt when you come to the text, you know straight away who it is. I'm not sure if you're interested, but whether you're interested or not, you will know soon. Then we have the other ones. Yeah, we have themselves being liable to grow older. Understanding the drawbacks in being liable to grow older, you seek the freedom from old age, the supreme sanctuary, extinguishment. Yeah, the drawbacks in growing older. I don't know, are you aware of those drawbacks? Maybe it depends on how old you are, but there are some significant drawbacks in getting old. Yeah. And it is something really worthwhile reflecting on. And the younger you are when you reflect on these things, the more powerful it is. because it is right there within you, waiting to come out. It is already part of you. And when I see people, when I see a young person these days, I try to see the old age in that person straight away. Maybe that seems like a kind of a bit of a killjoy, yeah? You're seeing the old age in the young person. Yeah, we're supposed to celebrate youth, right? Buddhist monastics, we don't celebrate youth. We kind of just look at them, yeah, old age is right there under the surface. Okay, done with that one. And you're kind of finished. And it is very useful because when you see the old age under the surface, you don't get infatuated by the idea of youth. Youth is something that infatuates you, it intoxicates you. It is something that is so important in our society, the idea of being young. But actually, it is only so superficial because it only lasts for a short time. Then it fades away like a flower. It fades away, and before you know it, the wrinkles start to appear, you're becoming weak, your eyesight is going, and everything is going wrong with your body. This is kind of what is in front of every one of us. And sometimes, you're always going to get older, so even you may be quite old already, but remember, you're going to get still older again, right? So you haven't reached your kind of worst stage yet, so you have more badness to look forward to in the future. This is the idea of old age. And I find it very, very useful myself to see that. You see someone young. Actually, no, the old age is already there. And it makes youth far less interesting as a consequence. But the most important thing is to actually see old age in ourselves. And to me, this is kind of so powerful. You look at yourself in the mirror. And when you look at yourself in the mirror, sometimes you don't like what you see in the mirror. You see things coming out that you don't really want to see. You see wrinkles, you see gray hair, you see kind of things that are not really all that pleasant to see. And it's very fascinating to kind of watch the reaction of the mind when you see something that is unpleasant. When you see old age, when you look at yourself in the mirror, how do you feel? And very often the immediate reaction when you see old age in the mirror is a kind of rejection. Oh no, don't want to see that. You kind of turn away and you kind of refuse to see what actually is going on. It's just too painful, right? Why? Because you are attached to the way you look. Because you're attached to the idea of youth. You're attached to a certain idea, maybe of beauty or whatever it might be. And so it's painful to see, right? And then the second thing that we do after it's painful to see is we look for a way of fixing the problem. Right? How can we fix this problem? Okay, maybe we can dye our hair, right? Maybe we can put on some makeup. Maybe we can do some, Botox or plastic surgery or whatever. These kind of things. People do these things all the time. And it's fine. It's not really a problem as such. But notice what happens. First of all, there is the rejection. I don't want to see what is there. The second thing is to find the solution to old age, right? And that solution is found in somehow hiding the signs of old age, as if old age somehow can be stopped in its tracks. Are you going to succeed in stopping old age in its tracks? Of course not. It is still going to be there, just happening under the surface. And so there is a double problem here. First of all is the denial, which is kind of problematic. And the second problem is the feeling that we can actually do something about old age. It's the feeling that we are in charge. It's the feeling that we have the power. There's a power in our hands to deal with these realities of the world. It's a double problem. So what you should do when you see yourself in the mirror, you should stop, and you can maybe feel the denial right there. But wait, stop. This is the reality. I'm a Buddhist. I don't want to turn away from reality. If I turn away from reality, I'm just deluding myself. Do you want to be deluded, or do you want to have clarity? Do you want to see things as they actually are? If you want to see things as they actually are, stop. Wait. Allow it to sink in, the fact that you're getting old. It's okay. You have no choice anyway. And something very beautiful happens when you do that. The moment you accept that you are getting old, that moment you're also abandoning the intoxication of youth, the intoxication of being a certain person in a certain state. That is abandoned. And every time you abandon a kind of intoxication, clarity arises in the mind instead. This beautiful thing that happens. Stop. Stay with it. Accept it. This is the natural reality. I don't want to delude myself. What a stupid thing it is to delude myself. Accept the nature of the body. Suddenly clarity arises in the mind. Why? Because you are letting go of something. You're letting go of an idea of how the sensory world should be, because the body is part of that sensory world. And every time you let go of that five-sense world to some extent, you feel more peaceful. You're letting go of an attachment, and the mind calms down, the mind becomes peaceful, and the mind is much more ready for meditation practice as a consequence. So the actual outcome is very beautiful. Yeah, the mind turns away from the five-sense world because the five-sense world actually is no longer so interesting, because everything is falling apart. And then the mind turns towards the spiritual path instead, because that is the alternative. That clarity of the mind that you get when you see things according to reality, that clarity is part of the practice of the spiritual path. You understand the way things actually are. It's so simple. So incredibly simple, but so few people do this. The vast majority of people, they are in denial of the reality. Number two, they want to fix the reality. They want to fix old age. You cannot fix old age. It's impossible. It's always going to be there under the surface. So stop this idea that you are in charge. You're not in charge. Allow nature to take its course, and then understand that nature. And then the mind moves on to the spiritual practice instead. This is the power of contemplating old age in the right way. So you can see how there's a little bit of pain there because you have to confront reality. But in the larger picture, actually, it has a very powerful effect on the practice. And this is exactly what the Buddha is doing here, seeing the drawbacks in old age. You no longer seek for other things that are subject to old age in the world. No, you seek for the freedom from that old age. You seek for the supreme sanctuary, right? You seek for the extinguishment in self because you want to lead and go in a different direction. You understand that the direction you had before was wrong. Now you're heading in a different direction. So this is the idea of the noble search. And then the next one, it is when someone who is himself liable to fall sick. Understanding the drawbacks of being liable to fall sick seeks the freedom from illness, the supreme sanctuary, extinguishment. Right? What are the drawbacks in falling sick? Well, the drawbacks are that you feel terrible. Yeah, I don't know when you last got sick, but I'm one of those people who has pretty good health. I usually don't get very sick. Actually, I got sick quite recently. It wasn't so good. But sometimes everyone gets sick. Really, that's just the nature of things. And it feels really awful when you're sick. You're kind of just lying there in bed, kind of moaning and kind of, you know, trying to get over the illness or whatever. Very often when you fall sick, what happens? Well, what happens, the first thing you think is, well, where is the medicine? So I can become healthy again. This is kind of the first thought. So again, there's this idea that we are somehow in charge. Something has gone wrong, and now I'm going to fix it through medicine. I want to be in charge of my life. I want to be in charge of these illnesses. And again, it buys into this illusion that we are in control of the body. We can deal with things that are problematic and somehow overcome it. But of course, that's another delusion again. So when you fall sick, instead of being in denial about the sickness, instead of thinking that you are in charge and you can resolve the issue through medicines or by going to the doctor or whatever, instead of thinking like that, stop again. Feel that illness. What is it like to be sick? What is illness really like? And then understand that this is the nature of this body. This body is like this. You cannot avoid sickness. Nothing has gone wrong when you are sick. Everything has gone right. Yeah, you know that famous story by Ajahn Brahma. Sometimes Ajahn Brahma, I think he doesn't elaborate enough on his stories, because some of his stories are great. And this is the story where, you know, you are really sick and you go to the doctor. And when you go to the doctor, Ajahn Brahm says, you should never say, doctor, doctor, something is wrong with me. You should always say, doctor, doctor, something is right with me. I'm sick again today. Yeah. And then your doctor starts to wonder whether you are you know, quite sane, or maybe you should be sent off to see a psychologist or something. But that is right. Yeah, that is the truth. The truth is something is right. Nothing has gone wrong when you are sick. And when you accept that, but this is the nature of the body, even if you get something very serious like cancer, how do you feel if you get cancer? Are you, I expected that? Is that what you think? Or do you think, oh no, I've got cancer? Of course you have cancer. This is the nature of the body. Nothing has gone wrong when you get cancer. Nothing has gone wrong when you have heart, some kind of heart disease. This is the way the body works. And so you start to accept the nature of the body. And again, when you accept the nature of the body, what happens is that the interest in the body, the interest in the five-sense world actually dies down because you understand the drawbacks, understand the problem. And the moment you do that, again, the intoxication goes. Yeah, the intoxication with being healthy, the intoxication with being strong or whatever, that goes again. And you become peaceful as a consequence, because when the intoxication goes, and the intoxication is always an attachment to the five-sense world, when that goes, peace arrives in its place. And you move on to the spiritual path. The spiritual path becomes what matters, as it does right here for the Buddha to be. Yeah, why seek for other things that also get sick when sickness is a problem? Let me instead seek for the freedom from sickness. And when you seek for the freedom from the sickness, the sanctuary, extinguishment, that means you're moving on to the spiritual path. You understand what really matters in life. What matters are the spiritual qualities that we build up. That is what matters. Everything else in the world is really quite irrelevant. Okay. Then we have the next one. When someone who is themselves liable to die, understanding the drawbacks in being liable to die, seeks the freedom from death, the supreme sanctuary and extinguishment. So again, instead of seeking other things that are liable to die, you understand the drawbacks in being liable to die. So the drawbacks are pretty obvious, yeah. If dying is kind of again, it's maybe the most powerful thing that happens in a person's life is when you die. Yeah, why is it so powerful? Because you have to give up everything. It's kind of, on the one hand, you have to give up everything you know, and on the other hand, you're going into some kind of uncertain future. It's kind of a double whammy, yeah, giving up everything and going on to something uncertain. It's kind of a scary time. That's why dying is the most powerful point in our life and has a very powerful spiritual significance precisely because of that. So you understand the drawback of dying, right? So how do we deal with this? How can we make this real? And there's a number of things that we can do. The first thing that we should do is to take it very seriously, the idea that dying is something that can happen at any time. Very often we think of death, we are not really ready to die. You think that you will be ready to die when it actually happens. But there's only one time you can be ready to die, and that is now. And if you're not ready to die now, the chances are you will not be ready when it actually happens. Now is the opportunity to be ready. Now is the only time you have. And if you put it off, then when it eventually happens, it's going to be too late. So there's many ways of reflecting on this, to make it real in a sense. And one of the ways of making it real that we're going to die is to actually look at all the people who die around us. When you read the newspaper or you see the news some way or you hear about someone who is dead, I always like this study. I've talked about this many times before, but there was a nice study that was done in a university in South Africa. And there was, what are the reactions of people when they read about someone who has died? They open up the newspaper, and they read about all the people who have died because there's always kind of lots of accidents and bad things happening in the world. And so what happens when you read about other people who have died? Well, what happens in those cases, they found out, is that they other those people. They distance themselves from those people as if those people are not really relevant to their life. It's the feeling that, well, these other people, they made a mistake, or they lived in the wrong place, or they ate the wrong food, or they didn't exercise, or they did something wrong. I don't do that wrong, but they did it wrong. So that's why they died. I don't die, right? You're othering the other people. But that is the wrong way of thinking about it, because death is always around us. Death is always a possibility. So the right way to thinking about it, when you see someone in the paper who has died, that could be you. That is the right way of thinking about it, because you are not inherently different from them. Just because they happen to live in Ukraine, because Ukraine is invaded and Australia is not invaded, it doesn't mean that that possibility doesn't exist in Australia. It's just going to happen in a different way. You're going to be eaten by a great white shark instead when you go down to the beach next time. That's kind of the problem in Australia. Or the bushfire is going to burn you, or something like that. There are problems in Australia as well, just like there is anywhere else. Or suddenly there is some kind of natural catastrophe. There is the massive bushfires that we had over in the eastern states just recently. There's some terrible things happening here as well. It's just different from overseas. So when you read about someone dying somewhere, remember, it could be you. Make it real. Don't other that person. Instead of othering them, try to see yourself in their place. You could have been there. They could have been in your place. We don't know what's going to happen down the track. Allow the reading about such people to remind you of the ever presence of death. That is the right way of thinking about it. The Buddha in the suttas, he says that the way to think about dying is to also think about all the ways that we can die. To remember that dying can happen for so many trivial, weird kind of reasons. Sometimes you hear stories about someone that is walking down the street and they stumble on something, they fall over and they die. It's so random sometimes. You read the paper, you read about people dying at all kinds of ages. Maybe you think that you're too young to die. No, you're never too young to die. If you are alive, that is when you can die. It is whether you're alive, that is what matters. If you're alive, you can die. If you're not alive, okay, then you're okay. But presumably you are alive, right? Otherwise, you are a zombie, which is kind of even more scary. So kind of, if you're a zombie, please leave now. Okay, no one leaving. Okay, good. So this is what it is all about. And so then you make it real. And then you start to, this really changes your attitude, right? And when you feel that you can die at any time, if you feel that you could die when you walk out of this hall or tomorrow or whatever, what does that do to you? And what it does to you, it actually changes what is important in your life. No longer are all the things of the world, they are no longer important to you, because you're going to be out of here anyway. They don't matter. What matters is what you are right here and right now. And guaranteed that it's going to make you a better person if you let go of all the things of the world and you just focus on what is right here and right now. Suddenly this is what matters, because it is as if you're always on your deathbed. In a sense, we are always on our deathbed. We're always waiting for death to happen. And if you're always on your deathbed, you become a far better person as a consequence. Your mind clears up. Your mind understands what should be prioritized in the world. The spiritual things need to be prioritized, because those are the things that matter. Everything that belongs to this world is going to have to go. But what is spiritual? What is your character? What your character is like? How you deal with other people? These are the things that start to matter instead. So again, it shifts your view. When you understand that you are subject to dying, suddenly you become a more spiritual person. It changes the direction of your life. This is exactly what is happening here to the Buddha to be. Instead of being focusing on other things that are going to die, he is again seeking the freedom from death, the supreme sanctuary, extinguishment. So try the idea of dying. Of all of these contemplations here, you could argue that they all come together in the idea of death contemplation. Death contemplation is the most powerful one, because it kind of brings with it illness and old age and all of these things in one thing. And this is what you see in the suttas. You see death contemplation being mentioned in many, many, many times. And the Buddha specifically says it should be done by everyone, whether you are a monastic or a layperson, doesn't make any difference. Why? Because it gives rise to a feeling of what should be prioritized in your life, what is important in your life. That is the reason why. So try to do a bit of death contemplation. Ideally, every day, a bit of death contemplation, because it changes again. You start to understand the nature of life and what is important in life. All right. So then we come to the next one. It's when someone who is themselves liable to sorrow understand the drawbacks of being liable to sorrow, seeking the freedom from sorrow, the supreme sanctuary, extinguishment. Yeah, life, you are liable to sorrow. Life can be very harsh sometimes. Yeah, the people who are closest to us, eventually they will have to die. And sometimes the grief and the sorrow in the world can be very, very overpowering. I'm sure everyone here has had times when you have felt a sense of grief in your life. And that grief, if you are very attached to somebody, can be extremely powerful. It can be completely debilitating. It can almost destroy your life. And sometimes when someone close to you dies, then that grief can go on for months and years sometimes. It may never leave you completely if you're very close to another person. And this is the nature of existence. This is part of life. We cannot avoid that. And the weird thing is that the more happy your relationship is with someone else, the more attached you are to another person, the more powerful that grief is going to be down the track. Yeah, it's kind of, it's like almost like you're paying a penalty for having a good life with someone else. And that penalty is the sorrow and grief that must come, but that must arise as a consequence. There was a beautiful simile in the suttas where it talks about when the five sense world, the Buddha says, is like having a debt. If you enjoy, if you kind of desire things in the five sense world, you're incurring a debt at the same time. And that is precisely what this is about. Whenever we attach to something, especially to the people around us, but also to the things in our life, because we can also sorrow over things, right? If your house burns down, guaranteed you're going to sorrow if your house burns down. But especially human relationships are the most difficult things of all. And so the better, the more attachment we have in that world, the greater is going to be the sorrow and lamentation and pain and grief and despair that happens when it actually comes to an end. It's kind of weird, yeah? You're paying the debt of attachment. You're paying the debt of desiring things in that five-sense world, of attaching to it, of clinging to it. And that is the result. So sorrow is part of life. And it kind of tempers the enjoyment. If you remind yourself that when you are really happy, when you have a very good time in your life and things are really going really well, if you remember that sorrow is kind of around the corner, it's kind of destroys the happiness a little bit. So sometimes you don't want to think about it. And because you don't want to think about it, you're really in denial about that reality. And then when it comes, it hits you like a double whammy. Why? Because you've been trying to escape it through indulgence. And that indulgence just makes it worse when it actually happens. This is the nature of sorrow. It's part of life. It cannot really be escaped from unless you move on to the spiritual path. And that is where an escape from sorrow actually exists. And then we come to the very last one of these. It's when someone who is themselves liable to be corrupted understands the drawbacks in being liable to be corrupted, seeks a freedom from corruption, the supreme sanctuary and extinguishment. And this is what I was talking about before, is the idea that corruption of the mind, the defilements of the mind, the changes of the mind, they're always there, potentially present make you and the people around you worse people. You don't know what's going to happen next. You don't know whether you're going to turn to becoming a better person or a worse person or whatever. It's not really under your control. the feeling that it is under your control, that is precisely the false feeling of a sense of self that we talk about in Buddhism. So again, you turn away from that because you don't want to be corrupted in the future. So you see the danger and you seek again, you move on to the spiritual path and you practice that to reach the supreme sanctuary, extinguishment. This is the noble search. So there you are. And what is so interesting about these things to me is how simple they are. This is the right view of the Buddha to be before his awakening. Yeah, this is what he was thinking, what he was reflecting on. These are the things that made a Buddha in the world. They are very, very simple reflections. And it shows that the spiritual path is not very complicated. The reason why the Buddha to be was able to find awakening based on these very simple things is because he thought about them in a very profound way. And that is really our job. Our job is to think about these things, reflect on them in the same way as the Buddha to be reflected on them, to make them very, to understand them in a profound sense, what is really going on. And the way to do that, to get the profundity, is to think about it again and again and again and again, so that gradually the perceptions of your mind change and you start to look at the world in a different way. You start to understand what actually really matters. Moving away from the five sense realm, moving towards something more profound, moving on to the spiritual path instead. And perhaps you think that this is going to be incompatible with your lay life, with your family life or whatever. But no, it isn't incompatible at all with these things. Because if you become a more spiritual person, if you become a more kind person who values kindness, who values generosity, who values compassion, all of these kind of things, then all of your life is going to become better. Yeah, your family life, your work life, your friends or whatever it is, all of these areas of your life is going to become better. So it actually has a very positive impact on your ordinary life. Just because you're moving onto the spiritual path doesn't mean that you become callous and hard-hearted and uncaring. Actually, it means the opposite. So very often the idea of practicing the spiritual path actually means also a benefit in your worldly life at the same time. There's a double benefit here. This is the beauty of this. So don't be afraid that you are going to kind of, you have to give up everything in the ordinary world. You don't have to do that. And it's not as if you just become a monk or a nun automatically by thinking these thoughts. No, these are thoughts that actually are applicable to everyone. So there you are. So again, this is all about right view. Very, very simple ideas of right view. And please consider these things very carefully. These are things that every one of us can do because they are so simple, and yet they are so extraordinarily powerful. This is what is so interesting about this. Okay, so that is all for now. So please keep on enjoying yourself, and we'll see you back again at 7:30. Is that right, Leha? 7:30? Yeah, 7:30.